Tonight we have a talk by Dr. Lauren Stewart. Lauren is a senior lecturer and director of a new MSc course in Music, Mind and Brain at Goldsmiths, University of London. Her current research interests range from studying those with congenital amusia who have an inability to make sense of musical sound to studying the acquisition of perceptual, cognitive and motor skills in trained musicians. Lauren originally studied psychological sciences at Balliol College, Oxford, but transferred from bodies to brains with an MSc in neuroscience and doctoral and postdoctoral training at the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience, at the Wellcome Department of Imaging Neuroscience, both UCL and Harvard Medical School. So quite an academic career. So we welcome Lauren tonight, and thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Nathan. So it's very nice to be here. I think this is the first time I've been asked to speak to an audience of engineers, which is a bit scary for me. And there's not going to be any engineering in this lecture, so I hope you're up for something a little bit different, which is to think a little bit about the music cognition and how music might be processed in the brain, which is what I'm currently engaged in. So first of all, I want to say that music, the ability to make sense of and appreciate music, has been seen in all cultures since the beginning of recorded history. And this ability to make sense of musical sound fulfills a multitude of different functions. So in infancy, we can engage with the sing-song interactions with our caregivers, and in later life, it kind of shapes our social and cultural identities. So this is really a very important aspect of life for most people, and it's something that actually doesn't require any musical training at all. So we get this for free. And most people would say that they don't consider themselves musical unless they can play a musical instrument. And I think this really misses the point that actually a large amount of musical perception is doesn't require any formal musical training, and we just manage to acquire this from early life. So it's firstly, it's a whole brain activity, so there is no centre in the brain for music. There's actually very few areas of the brain that are not involved in musical perception. So it's really an orchestration of different cortical and subcortical, so deeper areas of the brain, interacting with each other across both hemispheres. Now, music doesn't exist in the outside world, and it doesn't even exist at the point at which it hits our eardrums. So the process of perceiving music is an active construction that our brains do. And it's a remarkably sophisticated thing. So basically, when we're listening to a piece of music, typically it's not just a single line of music. Typically it's several interwoven lines. And we not only can keep track of those individual lines that are playing together, but we can also relate what the incoming sound to what's gone before, and we can also make predictions about what's going to come next in the music. And many people argue that the emotional impact of music is to do with this ability we have to predict what's coming next in music. And what the argument goes that we're hardwired to make predictions about the world around us, which is very necessary for survival. And we're so sort of wired up to do this that we do it even when we're not in a sort of life or death situation. And it's because the brain rewards us for making accurate predictions about what's going to happen to ensure that we keep making correct predictions. When we have something like music, which is very complex and has got a very very complex structure with many different hierarchies, this is kind of like a super stimulus for the brain. So the possibilities for seeking pattern out of rather chaotic and complex signal can be very rewarding for the brain. So this it allows the brain to sort of do a workout, if you like, with this musical sound. Okay, so having said that that we get this ability for free and that many people find listening to music extremely pleasurable, I'm now going to spend the rest of my talk focusing on a group of people for whom this isn't the case. And you might think that that's a little bit strange to focus on people who can't do something as a way of understanding how the brain does music, but it's part of a long tradition, really, in neuropsychology of really understanding how things break down or fail to develop in order to understand how the normal system functions. It's not really until you come across people who've lost a particular ability or function that you really have an idea of what it is that they can't do, because we all take these abilities for granted. And one example of that that I just mentioned now, because I was involved in it today, is working with patients. So today I was monitoring, observing some brain surgery at the National Hospital at Queen Square. These are patients who have epilepsy, and they have parts of their temporal cortex removed to stop the seizures. And following surgery, they often complain that music sounds different, so it's all altered their perception in some way. I'm hopefully going to start working with these patients to see in what specific ways their perception of music changes pre- and post-operatively in relation to the specific parts of the temporal lobe that have been removed. So that's an example of a very useful kind of approach to understanding how the brain is able to perform these functions. But the group of people I'm talking about today are people who are congenitally amusic. So that means from birth, they've never been able to make sense of musical sound. The first example of this was written about in 1878 in the journal Mind. A man called Grant Allen wrote about a 30-year-old individual who reported lifelong difficulties in making sense of music. So to him, one tone sounded very much the same as another. And for instance, he needed different musical notes to be very far apart before he could hear them as distinct. So that's the interval that he required to be able to say, oh yeah, now I can hear that they're different notes. And that's orders of magnitude bigger than the thresholds for most normal listeners. He also didn't have what's called octave equivalence, so the idea that subjectively middle C is rather similar to the C an octave above and an octave below. And he didn't have a concept of dissonance or consonance, so the idea that the combinations of tones can sound more or less pleasing depending on those particular combinations. So it all sounded much of a muchness to him. So this was just a case report without any kind of empirical investigation. But Grant Allen wrote, all psychologists are now agreed upon the necessity for a greatly extended study of individual peculiarities. And I shall be glad if the case which I detail arouses other workers to similar examinations of very unmusical persons amongst their acquaintance. So this was a call to arms for people to really start researching what might be going on with these cases of disordered musical perception. But it was more than 100 years later when Isabelle Peretz, who is working at the University of Montreal, really started to look into this condition. And she'd done some work with people with acquired amusia, so following stroke, they'd experienced difficulties in perceiving different aspects of music. But people who were congenitally amusic have only started to be studied very recently. She used something called the Montreal Battery for the evaluation of amusia, which she developed herself. And this comprises six different subtests that probe selectively different aspects of musical listening. And all of the subtests involve listening to two tunes and saying whether the tunes are exactly the same or slightly different. And when they are different, the differences are actually rather salient. So, for instance, so I don't know if there's anyone in this room who didn't hear the difference, but it's possible. I do get people coming up to me after talks who say, well, yeah, I just really didn't hear it. And that would be interesting to me. So if that does apply, we can have a quick word at the end. So this is the Montreal Battery. So she appealed for people to come forward who considered themselves to have difficulty with music. So at this stage, nobody had really defined or diagnosed congenital amusia, but she used the national press to advertise for people who might fit this category. And they came forward, and she tested them with the Montreal Battery. And she also she gathered a normative sample of data with this battery, so she had a comparison of several hundred data sets with which to compare these the scores of individuals who reported difficulties with music. And she found that they were indeed more than two standard deviations away from the normative sample. And when she tested them further, she found that they couldn't recognise tunes that would be familiar to others from the same culture, though they could recognise the same tunes via lyrics. They did sing out of tune, but they were unaware of it unless they'd had friends or family tell them this, and she coined the term congenital amusia. This is where, okay, so what I'd like to say is this isn't just people who can't sing in tune, of which I'm sure all of you know several such people. And in fact, there was a recent article about the call to prayer. So there's many imams, apparently, in Istanbul who issue the call to prayer, but are so shockingly out of tune that it's prompted many complaints, and these imams have been sent to singing school, apparently. So there are many people who can't sing, and certainly there's a subgroup of those people who also have perceptual problems, but there's many for whom it's just a production issue, and a bit of training would overcome that. But the people I'm working with definitely don't sing in tune, and that's secondary to a primary perceptual problem, because of course you need to be able to perceive what you're singing in order to monitor what you're producing and to kind of do the correct feedback loop to make sure that you're spot on in terms of tuning. Now, this is where my own research comes in. So I was working with Tim Griffiths a few years ago in 2006, an auditory neurologist from Newcastle, and we were interested to look a little bit more closely into congenital amusia to see what really might be the core problem in this disorder. So we put I wrote a feature for the BBC News website, and we linked a little screening test to that feature, which was an online version of the scale subtest from the Montreal Battery. And because it was on the BBC, it was extremely popular, and the test has now been taken more than 170,000 times now. So this was really amazing for us. We were just after a small sample of people to start working with. But because we had so much uptake of the screening test, we really had a great access to people who were potentially amusic. So, of course, this is a very sort of skewed distribution. So basically all subtests are out of 30, and most people score 26 or 27. They do very well. We're interested in people at this tail end, and according to the published cutoffs by Isabel Peretz, people can be considered amusic if they score 21 or below. So if we get people who score in that range, we ask them to retake the test, and if they still score in that range, and they're in the London area, we invite them in and we administer the full battery of tests, and we do audiometry to check there's no trouble with their peripheral hearing, and we do a few background cognitive tests to make sure they haven't got any general intellectual or learning difficulties. And we're now working with 40 such people who we've confirmed to be amusic, and we're trying to answer a few questions. So we're interested to know what might the core underlying deficit be in this disorder, if there is a single underlying core deficit. Of course, there might be a number of different distinct underlying problems. Are there implications outside the musical domain if you have amusia? So Here I'm thinking about what about the melody of speech, so intonation, is there any problem there? Does the ability to appreciate music depend on having intact perception of it? And finally, the neurobiology of a musia, does it have a genetic basis and are there some structural brain correlates that we can find? So straight on to the first question, what might the core underlying deficit be? We're doing some, we've done some auditory psychophysics. So basically, with these tasks, we're asking what is the just perceivable difference in pitch that these individuals are sensitive to. So we're using what's called an AXB design, where they just have to spot the odd one out. It's either in the first or the last position, never in the middle, and they know that. And things start off very easy, so which is the odd one out. And we use adaptive tracking, meaning things start off easy. If you get two trials correct at that level, things get the target is made more difficult, and we have variable step sizes. So as the experiment goes on, we use finer and finer changes in pitch difference to work out where people's performance plateaus, if you like. So this is measuring their threshold for the simple detection of a pitch change. We use glides here, and that's just to minimise demand on memory. But if you did it with do-do, it would also be the thresholds are not appreciably different. These two are measuring discrimination of pitch direction. So all the sounds change in pitch. One changes in the opposite direction to the others. And this is a pure version of this because you can't use the start or end points of the sounds to do the task. So you really have to abstract the direction, whereas in this case, you could conceivably be comparing the end point of this and the start of the next. So these are the tests I just showed you, and what you see here is the thresholds for each of them. For our group of A-music individuals and a group of non-A-music controls who are matched on gender, age, and musical training background, which is to say most of them have got very little musical training. Now, for this simple detection of pitch change, thresholds are extremely low in both groups. This is a single outlier, so each dot is a different individual. Now, apart from this person here, all of the thresholds in the A music group are below a semitone. So clearly, these problems that A musics are experiencing with real world music can't be accounted for just by poor ability to detect small pitch changes, because the smallest pitch change in Western music is a semitone, and they're all fine at detecting a change of a semitone and even below that. But things get a bit more interesting when we look at discriminating pitch direction. And you can see here that although there's some individuals who are equivalently good as controls, on average their thresholds are worse, and some individuals have got thresholds of 3 or even 5 semitones. So that means that even though they can detect a pitch change, they are not able to discriminate pitch changes that are going up versus going down, unless they're rather large. And when we use the pure test, the groups do pull apart to a greater degree, but even some of the controls start to find this rather tricky. But the kind of the bottom line from this picture is that there's no problem with the detection of pitch change, but there is a difficulty in discriminating the direction of a pitch change. So you think, well, why might that be important for musical perception? And I would argue that this discrimination of pitch direction is a building block of one of the key parameters of music perception, which is contour. So contour is the pattern of ups and downs in terms of pitch. And that's really what distinguishes one tune from another and really allows you to hold on to a tune and encode it in your long-term memory. Now, I told you that lots of people have taken this online screening test, and many of them have emailed us with their comments. One interesting comment we had was from a nun who works in Wimbledon in a convent. She has to sing plain chant which is very difficult for her. So she says, when the music finished, the sound was always gone, as though it had never happened. This bewildered me with a sense of failure to hold on to what I'd just heard. Others told me that if I tried to remember, I would, but I never did. I have no idea what people mean when they say, I have a tune going round in my head. I've never had a tune tell out its music in my head, let alone repeat itself. So this is very interesting because at the beginning I was telling you that we have this ability to integrate the incoming sound with what's gone before and to predict what's going to come next. But she seems to be describing something akin to a series of auditory snapshots. So she doesn't seem to have this window of integration. At least that's what her comments suggest. But we wanted to test this empirically in the group of Vein Musics that we were working with. So we came up with a measure of pitch span. So a measure of the number of items, of number of tones really, that vary in pitch that you can hold on to in short-term memory. So this task involved listening to two sequences of tones and saying whether they were the same or different. Versus. Okay, so when there is a difference, the order of the second and third items is flipped. Yeah. Now things again start off easy. Actually, they started off with two items per sequence, and then depending on performance, they get harder and harder. So the sequence length increases as long as you're getting these trials correct. And again, we find the limit of your ability to do this task. And just as a control, because we want to see if these people have got any general short-term memory problems, we came up with a digit span. So
5, 8, 1, 2.
And again, we build up the sequences and we find out when people can no longer hold this information in memory. And very monotonic speech, that's because we don't want to have any pitch variation, obviously, so that we can rule that out as a difficulty. What we find here is that on the digit span, there's no significant difference between our two groups, but on the pitch span, the A music individuals have got significantly shorter spans compared to the controls. And this can't be accounted for by their elevated pitch thresholds, because the intervals that we used in these short sequences of tones were definitely supra-threshold for perception. So we knew individuals' thresholds for perceiving a pitch change, and we made sure that the intervals that we used in this memory task were well above that threshold. So we're really trying to isolate pitch memory as a separate thing from the perception of these pitch changes. Okay. Right, so I'm talking... So they seem to have these problems with discrimination of pitch direction, and that appears to have knock-on consequences for their ability to build up a contour, if you like, so a longer, a larger scale representation of music. And we're used to thinking of contour in terms of pitch information, so the pattern of ups and downs in terms of pitch. But there was a very recent, a very interesting paper recently in Psychological Science by Josh McDermott and Andy Oxenham, and they basically provided evidence that contour may not be solely about changes in pitch, but that you can extract a contour from a change in, for instance, intensity or even spectral properties. And I want to illustrate this by doing a little experiment. I'll play you a tune that you will be familiar with, all of you, that has been transformed. So in the first case, which is going to be a control, it's only got the rhythm information. So there's no contour information at all. It's on the same pitch, and it just has basically the temporal variation of this familiar tune. Then I'm going to play you the same tune where instead of pitch changes, you're going to get changes in intensity. So it's a noise burst that just Instead of going up in pitch, it gets louder. Instead of going down in pitch, it gets softer. So basically transforming those familiar tunes into intensity contours and here into a spectral contour. So if you know what the tune is, put your hand up, but don't say what it is. That's just timing information, but I don't know, somebody might... Okay, two brave people. Well, okay. I wonder if you're thinking what I'm thinking. So now for the first example of a contour that's not pitch contour. Anyone else got that? Yeah? And you two, are you still thinking the same song, the same thing? Ah. Oh, really? Okay. Okay. Listen to this again. Yeah, a few people getting it. I'll play you the spectral one now. Yeah. Who's got it? Oh, about half of you. And what is it? Yeah. So now listen to... Okay. So that was very interesting because it suggests...
Can you just play the first one again?
The intensity one. So was out of interest, did you get it from that first one?
No.
No, you thought it was something else. I think that's because many nursery rhymes have got that same temporal structure. So at that point, it could be anything, really. And that's my point about how contour makes something distinctive, because otherwise, if you just got timing, it really could be anything. So this is interesting for me because having sort of demonstrated that these people have got a problem in representing pitch-based contours, I'm now interested to see if they've got a problem with representing contour in general. So we're in the process of measuring their thresholds for discriminating direction change, and not only in pitch but also in intensity. And we've only run four people so far, but they do look like they've got elevated thresholds for the discrimination of an intensity change. So this task involves listening to pairs of noise bursts and saying which of the pairs goes in the opposite direction to the others. So, that's an example of a fairly easy one where it was the last pair that was different. And again, we start off easy and then the differences in intensity get smaller and smaller and we work out the thresholds. So it could be that their problems are not just restricted to pitch contour but to contour more generally. And that would be of interest because it would suggest that that contour is a more abstract representation and that the problems in music are a specific manifestation of something a little bit more general. So we've got more to do on that before I can give you any definitive answers. So the interim summary is that it's a pitch perception deficit, particularly with pitch direction, resulting in an inability to build melodic contours. Just moving on now, are there implications outside the musical domain? Now, I'm thinking here of speech, the melody of speech. This question has begun to be answered already by the team of Isabel Peretz with a task where people had to discriminate between spoken utterances that differed only in terms of their intonation.
He likes to talk about romance novels. He likes to talk about romance novels.
Okay. And a non-speech version. So replacing each syllable with a tone that has the same mean fundamental frequency as those speech examples. Now, this gets at... So the question of interest here is, well, if they're impaired are there deficits specific to music, or do they extend... Well, okay, are they... no one would really argue that what I've just played you is music, but really... It's an interesting question in general in psychology, the degree to which the processing of pitch is what's called domain-specific. So is it the case that the brain has an independent pitch processing mechanism for pitch changes in speech and a different pitch processing mechanism when it's processing pitch outside of language, so, for instance, during music? And if that's the case, that you have sort of independent processes, then you'd predict that the people with amusia should be okay on this, but perhaps not okay on this, yeah? That the performance on the two might dissociate. And that's actually what they found. So here's the data for amusix and in white controls. So you can see that both groups do equivalently well on speech, but for non-speech, the controls are just as good, but the performance of the amusix drops off. So that suggests, that's a bit intriguing in a way, because if you think about it, in this task, the only way you can discriminate these two spoken utterances is by noticing the difference in the pitch pattern. But when you've only got a pitch pattern to compare, their performance seems to fall off. So it sort of suggests, or it seems to suggest, that embedding a pitch change within a linguistic context seems to really facilitate processing in amusia. So that was kind of very surprising and sort of quite striking. But I think that there's another explanation for this pattern of results that is not simply due to domain specificity of pitch processing, such that the two can dissociate. Because you could do this task by simply tagging the place in the utterance where there's a salient pitch change and listening out for that same place in the second utterance. So he likes to talk about romance novels. So you're now listening out for talk in the second utterance. And if it also has a salient pitch change, then they're the same, otherwise not. But when you're doing the same task with the non-speech, you have to encode the whole pitch pattern because you don't have any way of tagging as you do in the speech example. And if it's the case, as I've suggested, that there are limits on short-term memory for pitch, then this could be the kind of task that they would really fail on in this situation. So working with Fang Li, who's a linguist and an expert on intonation processing, particularly in tonal languages, we came up with a new set of stimuli where basically we tried to avoid the possibility that that participants could use a strategy in this case that wasn't available, a strategy in this case that wasn't available to them in this case. So we asked them to discriminate between statements and questions, and the only difference between the statements and questions was that either a pitch fall or a pitch rise at the very end. So
she grew up in Ely. She grew up in Ely.
So that sounds very much like Donald Duck, I think. But what you see, and there's a nonsense speech condition as well. Now, what you see here is that the results for controls are universally good, almost perfect, in fact. And the results for the amusix are significantly worse across the board. So in this case, where we've ensured that there's no strategy available that would differ between these two conditions, and when we've used... So we're using natural speech, but some of the but the pitch variation was quite subtle. We actually see that people with amusia do have problems in perceiving intonation changes.
Have you looked at bearing in mind this pitch control business with speech? Have you looked at songs with vocals versus instrumental material?
Oh, no, we haven't done that.
If there's a difference in the ability to recognise pitch contours.
Well, that's what... Okay, but so that would be the case if they had shown a dissociation between natural speech and non-speech. But this experiment shows that actually pitch seems to be impaired both within speech and outside of speech. So by that, I mean, we haven't tested it, and we could do, but we wouldn't predict a difference, I think, with this paper, with this set of results. And just to give you an idea of the some of the sort of subtle distinctions that amusics typically missed. So this is the final word of a sentence.
Nay, nay, demo, demo, Romany, Romany.
So, I mean, not negligible at all, still quite discernible to most people, but nevertheless they did have trouble with that. And actually Fang is currently in Beijing, and she's just tested a group of Chinese amusics. So so some collaborators in Beijing had already identified a group of Chinese amusics using the Montreal battery, and Fang has now gone out to test them on various different linguistic tasks, and she has found that the Mandarin speakers definitely do have problems on these linguistic tasks. And and the implication of that is different for speakers of tonal language, where it's very critical to accurately perceive the pitch variation. So in the English language non-tonal languages in general, then there's typically other information present in the in speech to tell you whether something's a statement or question, or to give you information about emotion. So, but in tonal languages, pitch variation can make all the difference in terms of the semantic interpretation of a spoken utterance. So, so I'm looking forward to seeing the data when she gets back. Okay, so just building up on our summary here. In our hands, this doesn't look to be a domain-specific problem, and it does extend to speech intonation when pitch contours are subtle. Moving on now to ask the question whether appreciating music requires you to have intact musical perception. Now, we're working with a few people, a few amusics, who suggest that they find music very unpleasant. So one person said, I used to go to concerts, it was the thing to do, but I didn't enjoy it really. My husband asked me what music I liked. I said, loud music. I married him and he played Mozart. I said, turn off that awful noise. We went to operas. I slept through several of them. He really nagged me. We got divorced. Not a very happy ending. A different person, if I have to go to an event involving music, I get very anxious weeks beforehand and I try to work out coping strategies. Probably because of this, I'm not a social mixing type of person. This really points out the fact that music is all around us. So you can't really have a social occasion without really encountering music, whether you want it or not. So she's alluding to the fact that unless, you know, that she really chooses to shut herself away and not really meet, you know, not really go out because of the presence of music, which is, you know, quite extreme for it to have that kind of repercussion. But maybe these people are, you know, just a couple of people, whereas maybe the other amusics find music okay to listen to. We wanted to see what the general pattern was. So we came up with three questionnaires to give them, and we drew on the large literature on the social psychology of music that told us the kinds of situations that people listen to music in. So taking a bath while exercising, reading, doing study, doing the chores, driving, etc. And we also knew from that literature the psychological functions that music serves for people. So many people like getting a shiver down the spine when they listen to music. Other people use music to relax, to uplift them, to match their mood, for instance. And we also knew a lot about the kinds of ways in which music is used in public places. So we asked a music group and our match controls the extent to which they would use music in these situations, would identify with these psychological functions, and how much music would impact upon their appreciation or their experience of these sort of public situations. Again, each point is an individual person, and what you can see again is that there's a great deal of overlap. But on but at the group level, A-Musics use music in everyday contexts much less than controls, and they identify with fewer of these psychological functions. They are more negative about music in public places, but that effect size is smaller than for the other two, and that's because controls also find music irritating when it's in public places, because it's beyond their control, and they deem it to often not have a very good fit to their particular situation, which seems to be quite important. Okay, so one thing that was interesting to us was to say, well, okay, so these people don't use music much, but these people use it as much as controls, and these people don't recognise any of these functions, but there's at least a few of them that are similar to controls. So we identified a third of our A-Music participants who did seem to use music just as much and for the same purposes as controls, and we tried to figure out if there was anything different about those people who perceptually were different, perceptually were not making sense of music in a way. Were they any different to the other A-Musics who were also not perceiving music very well, but nevertheless... okay, so we had subgroups, basically. What we found was that these people who could appreciate music were not simply the more mild cases, so perceptually they were just as poor as the A-Musics who didn't use music very much. They tended to be the younger participants. So basically, if you're A-Music, and you're more likely to appreciate music if you're younger. And we came up with a possible explanation for this, which is to do with almost a socio-cultural explanation, which is to suggest that for younger people, music is very important in shaping social and personal identity. And it may be that it's not even possible when you ask adolescents, do you like this piece of music? It's very possible that they are not able to dissociate what they think of the piece on its own merits from what they think of the culture surrounding that music. So that they really are using music because of the associations and because of the lifestyle and things like this. Whereas older people who are more sort of secure in their personal and social identities are able to make judgments about whether they like music based on the music itself. So it's a speculative argument, but it may have some support in the published literature. But the other possible explanation for why we have these subgroups of A-Musics, some of which appreciate music, some of which don't, relies on something to do with perception. So it could be that these people who don't appreciate music may not only have problems with pitch that are typically picked up with the Montreal Battery, but they might have an additional problem with timbre. And that's not measured in the Montreal Battery. But we have... I've basically published a review of acquired cases of amusia, so people who, following stroke, have lost certain aspects of musical function. And we basically mapped the aspect of musical listening to the particular area in the brain that seemed to be affected. This is a schematic of the brain going this way through the head. And you can see the preponderance of cases on the right side. This is kind of thresholded, so it's not the case that there were no that there were no instances of left brain damage resulting in amusia, but the preponderance on the right may reflect a bias whereby many people who've had strokes are more worried about a loss of language than they are a loss of musical perception. But nevertheless, what we observed, which is relevant here, is that problems in pitch pattern perception are in a similar area to problems in timbral perception. So it could very well be that also developmentally, if the circuits are not getting configured to process pitch and pitch pattern, there would also be... in some cases, associated problems with timbre, and that's what we're starting to look at now. So it could be that if you've just been hit on the pitch aspect, you might be able to appreciate music, but if you have a double hit for pitch and timbre, that might limit your appreciation. Okay, just coming on now to the neurobiology of amusia. There have been a couple of studies, of structural neuroimaging studies, to try to ascertain whether people with amusia have got subtly different brains. And there have been a study done in Montreal and Newcastle, and basically a conjunction analysis of their results converged on a particular area of the frontal cortex, which suggested that people with amusia have a reduced density of grey matter in a part of the frontal cortex. And a subsequent study also replicated this frontal finding, but also found that there were differences in the temporal lobe. So, of course, music perception relies on auditory cortex predominantly, so it was a bit rather surprising initially that the findings were mainly in the frontal cortex, and only sort of, when you look very hard, also in the temporal cortex. But actually, these two areas, the temporal and the frontal cortex, are connected by a large fiber tract. And some functional neuroimaging studies have shown that really, as soon as you're doing anything more complex than perceiving single tones, perceiving the pitch of single tones, so for instance, you're building up a pitch pattern, then the frontal cortex becomes recruited. So you don't have to be doing anything terribly sophisticated to require this frontotemporal pathway to get involved. And a recent study using a sort of state-of-the-art approach to structural neuroimaging called diffusion tensor imaging has shown that indeed the pathway between this temporal area and the frontal area is weaker, so it's a bit impoverished in terms of the connections between these two areas. So that's where we are with the neurobiology at the moment, although there definitely is room for more studies there. But let's think about the heritability of the disorder. So having shown you now these structural imaging studies, you might think, well, that seems to be convincing that, you know, this is a biological disorder, clearly. But on the other hand, I've worked with musicians who have had a lifetime of training, and we know that that practice and training can alter the structure of the brain, in as little as 3 months, really. So the capacity of the brain to change and reorganize is very impressive, and it used to be thought that this only happened in children, but now we know that this can happen in lifelong. So a skeptic of the biological account of amusia might say, well, maybe these are people who just have stayed away from music all their lives because perhaps their parents didn't let them listen to the radio because, I don't know, they've just essentially grown up without being around music and their brains haven't become configured to process music. So what we really need to argue a biological case is a family in whom there are multiple affected and unaffected individuals who have grown up in an incontrovertibly musical environment. And this is one such family, or at least two members of a very large family. So I told you that people take our online test, and we have a way of keeping data together that's from the same family. And I went into the database one day and I noticed that 20 members of the same family had taken the test and 10 of them were scoring in the amusic range. So I got in touch with them and I found out that they ran a family business selling traditional Irish musical instruments, which is very ironic. And they live in rural Northern Ireland, so I hopped a flight to go and meet them and to test them. And there's 33 of them across three generations. This is one of the sort of the second generation who is amusic, we've since found out. And this is her talking about her difficulties.
We've all been taught to play musical instruments, we've all went to dancing classes, and we've all had the same opportunity. And we've all tried really hard, and some have really flourished and others really struggled. I started Irish dancing when I was about 5 years old. And I continued Irish dancing until I was about 10 years old. And I desperately wanted to be a good Irish dancer. And I practiced so hard. But I was still at the same grade after all those years. And all the other girls and boys got moved up. And I never won anything in any competitions with them. I danced my heart out. I had no idea why I was still at the same grade. And dancing has always been a problem. My next experience really was regarding the singing. I wanted one of those children that wanted to be involved in everything in the community. And I desperately wanted to be in the choir, a church. I wanted to be in the various musicals, productions that the village that used to be put on in the village hall. And the earliest memories, I think I must have been about 7 or 8. That's happened several times. I used to turn up for when the roles were being allocated, and they always used to say, "Oh, we're really pleased you came, Anne, but we've filled all the positions and we don't need you now, but thank you for coming anyway." And I was disappointed, and I used to go home to my mum and I used to say, "Mum, I should have got there earlier. They've filled all the positions now. They don't need me anymore." And meanwhile, running parallel with this, I was learning to play the accordion, as where the whole family were being taught Irish traditional music. I was learning to play the accordion, and I think I played it for about 7 years on the formal music lessons. And although I learned to do music and I learned to play notes, I somehow it didn't seem to come to me as easily as my brother Sean, who could pick up the instrument and he just ran away with it.
Okay, and this is Sean running away with his accordion. So within the same family, there are people who have really, really struggled and others who, you know, do hours of music every day, teaching it, playing it. So they're from an area where it happens every Friday and Saturday night, so everyone gathers and plays traditional music. And it's not about sort of being formally good at music. It's more about joining in as opposed to sort of having achieved particular levels, but the level that they have achieved, these musical members of the family, is just really amazing, and they're very active in sort of the traditional Irish music scene there. Here's the third generation, the grandchildren. So when we were there, we tested them for audiometry just to check their hearing. We tested them on the Montreal Battery. We took some threshold data, and we took mouth swabs, saliva samples, so that we can to do a DNA analysis. And this is, we came up with a family tree. If you haven't seen one of these before, then squares are men, circles are women, black is affected, so amusic, and white is unaffected, and we've got just a couple of grey areas that are sort of borderline. So within Anne's generation, this is her, she's got 3 affected brothers, two unaffected sisters, an unaffected brother, and a grey area. And then in both the parents are affected, which is quite unusual. And in this third generation, it's rather difficult. The Montreal Battery is not sensitive to pick up problems in children under 16. So the most we can say about these people is, if they're under 16, is that if they score in the adult normal range, then they're not amusic. But if they're scoring in the adult amusic range, we can't say much about that, because it might just be that if we tested them once they're above 16, they might do better. Nevertheless, we're able to do a linkage analysis in collaboration with the mitochondrial research group in Newcastle, who've got a considerable expertise in that. And we're really asking whether there's regions of the of DNA that distinguish these affected versus the unaffected family members. And the working hypothesis is that any gene or set of genes may be involved in the coding of a protein that is involved in neuronal migration in early life. So I think back, if you think back to that pathway I told you about from the temporal to the frontal cortex, then that has to get wired up in early life, and perhaps there is problems with the migratory problems with the proteins that enable neuronal migration of that pathway to occur. That's just a hypothesis, and I can't tell you the results of that study quite yet, but we hope to have something soon. So wrapping up now, really, just to remind you what I've said, I think the core deficit has something to do with pitch direction, leading on to problems in representing contour. But now we're interested in asking whether it's to do with pitch direction or direction more generally, and that was the Frère-Jacques study that I told you about. There are implications outside the musical domain, especially when the pitch contrasts are subtle, and that has and that's really relevant for speakers of tonal languages, it seems. Appreciation versus perception of music can dissociate, as we've seen. So people can be poor at perceiving music, but nevertheless enjoy it and make use of it. We're interested in whether timbral perception can distinguish between those people who, those amusics that do versus do not enjoy music. And the genetic basis, it does look to be heritable, but the genes are await discovery. So I would sort of argue that the congenital amusia is a very nice model for understanding how we go from genes to the development of brain structure, and how we go from there to the emergence of a very complex and arguably uniquely human aspect of cognition. These are the people that I've been working with on this project, particularly Tim Griffiths, who got it all started. In my group at the moment, it's Fang Lee and Vicky Williamson. Guy Perrier also collected a lot of data. Sukhbinder Kumar collaborates on the psychophysics, and this is Arnie Patel, who's at San Diego, who collaborated on the linguistic work. And the work is funded by the ESRC, and in the past has been funded by the Wellcome Trust, with support also from Goldsmiths. If you're interested in this kind of research, or generally music cognition and music and the brain, and any of you use Facebook, we've set up a Facebook page. So if you would just search Music, Mind and Brain at Goldsmiths, you could become a fan, and then we basically post things that we think are of interest. And if any of you are thinking of returning to study, perhaps, do take a flyer from the front, which is about the master's programme in Music, Mind and Brain that I'm in charge of. Thanks for listening.
Do you have time for a few questions?
Of course, yeah.
Do we have any questions?
Your experiment seemed to suggest that these amusics had similar problems with pitch discrimination when it was speech.
Yeah.
But did you find anecdotally at all that they had problems speaking? You know, like phrasing a question as a question, for example.
Yeah, well, we've yet to do the appropriate controlled experiments on that. But what we have done is measured their natural running speech. So we got all of them to read a little story about Arthur the rat, I think it was. And we used laryngograph recordings to basically measure the control of the vocal folds. And we could also use acoustic measurements to measure pitch range and things like that. And according to those measures, they were not significantly different to controls. But then again, it's difficult to, in that kind of running speech situation, it's difficult to sort of have a model of what the correct intonation would be. So I think probably the most interesting way to address that would be maybe with the Mandarin speakers, to get them to produce particular lexical tones and see if they can actually do that or not. So that's something probably that Fang will be running in the future.
Who else had a, did you have a question? Oh, right.
Yes. Oh, okay.
Yeah, just two things, really. The people who had the operation, you talked about them hearing musically different after. How do they hear music differently after the operation?
Well, the case that I've been talking to the neurosurgeon about is an example of a woman who, whenever she hears music but not speech, it now sounds as though it's in the Royal Albert Hall. So the kind of the acoustic experience.
They've added reverb to her brain.
Pardon?
They've added reverb to her brain during the operation. Right.
But specifically for music, not speech, which is a bit strange. But Pete, I mean, Oliver Sacks has written about a few case studies of people who, I don't remember if it was a congenital case or acquired case, of a woman saying music sounds like a crashing of pots and pans. And he himself had, in his book, which I would recommend, Musicophilia, he talks about experiencing a migraine and having a transient disturbance in his musical perception, to the extent that I believe he was listening to the radio in his car, and he called in to the radio station to say, is somebody messing about? What's going on? And it was actually just that he'd been sort of having, I guess, the prelude to a migraine. And
And then the other question is, are you sort of long-term looking at what the brain does or what people immediately think when they first hear a piece of music?
I don't follow.
The first impact that a piece of music makes on the people that you study, have you asked them? The very first thought that comes into somebody's head when they listen to something?
No. You mean people in general, not necessarily people with the music?
Either, yeah.
No, but why... Do you think that's an interesting thing to do?
Yeah.
Why?
I'll ask you the question.
No, but...
Because I think we should know what it is that people listen to. How the brain... what's the emotion? The first translation that the brain makes.
Yeah, well, actually, there's quite good evidence that if it's a novel piece that you're not familiar with at all, and perhaps it might be outside the repertoire that you're familiar with, actually, when you first hear a piece, it's not very satisfying to you. And that's because you're not familiar enough with it to be able to make good predictions about where it's going next. So there's what's called an inverted U curve that basically the mere exposure effect. So the more you listen to a particular piece, the more you like it, until you hit a particular saturation point, after which you don't want to hear it anymore. So that sort of vertex must be the optimal point where you know it just enough to still enjoy making predictions about what's happening next. So the other book I would really recommend would be by David Huron, Sweet Anticipation, The Psychology of Musical Expectancy. And he develops this theory about prediction, and he talks about familiarity, and he talks about how we have a lot of inbuilt knowledge about the rules of music that we've gathered just by being exposed to the music of our own culture. And not only do we have rules about how Western music is in general, but we have rules that are specific to different genres. And that's, in a sense, how we can even classify a tune as belonging, or a piece as belonging to a particular genre, because we have, he calls them cognitive firewalls, which means we don't apply the same set of rules to Beethoven as we do to Britney Spears. You know, they're different things, and we sort of listen with a different mindset when we're listening to different pieces.
Is that a question, or is it a mic?
I had quite a lot of questions going on. Like 20 or 30 questions occurred to me, but I have short-term memory problems. I can't remember them all now. One thing I was interested in is a little bit... I was a bit unclear about some of the details of the methodology you were adopting. For example, when you were talking about whether people could detect differences between one sample and another, what sort of questions were you actually asking? Were you asking the question, can you detect a difference? Answer yes or no? Or were you asking them some other sort of question? Because that the nature of the question also determines, you know, what the answers are and what the inferences you might be able to draw from the answers.
Sure, sure. Well, in those early threshold ones, that was just basically a forced choice. Is it the first? Is the target the first or the last? Yeah, two alternative forced choice. And then the pitch memory was same or different. Are these two sequences same or different? And so the Montreal battery is also same or different. So we can do a signal detection.
What about the cases where you had different intonations on the speech, for example?
Same or different. But we also have a version where we ask them to identify, to say whether it's a statement or question. So, and that the pattern of results is very consistent, whether they're doing the identification or the discrimination.
I mean, one of the things that occurred to me, when you asked the... There are a number of different things you might hear when you hear a difference. I mean, when you gave your example, which you credit to the audience, I didn't recognise a tune. And I don't think it's because I'm amusical particularly, or suffering from amusia, but the fact is there are a number of different processes going on there about recognition. It's not just detecting the pitches or even just the times, it's also connecting with some memory. And that's, so mm-hmm. there's a whole lot of different processes going on there. So if you can do it or you can't do it, where is the failure in the process, considering there's lots of different things going on there?
Sure.
And what inferences can you draw from that, from the results? Because when there are a lot of different things going on, how do you separate the different possibilities?
So, I mean, until, I guess, the sort of early work on amusia was really just saying, look, amusia is people who score very poorly on the Montreal battery, which is discriminating these two tunes. And as you say, there's a lot of things that go on in that process. And that's why we wanted to break it down a little bit and look at detection of a pitch change, discrimination of a pitch change, the pitch span information. So I agree, that's kind of what we're trying to do, to sort of see which bits of that whole real-world music listening situation have gone wrong.
Okay. And are you sure that the results you think you're measuring are what you're actually measuring? Which is kind of the same question in the other way around. You have to look at exactly what you're doing to understand whether you can actually infer the results you're inferring from the results you've got. Because of the complexity of what you're doing, and there may be other things going on.
Yeah, well, we try to adopt stringent controls, but I mean...
So there's another slightly related question, but how do you know it's a function of the brain? I mean, that may seem a silly question, but if you think about colour defective vision, people don't invent problems with the brain in order to explain colour defect. They say, well, there's a problem with the retinal detection and so on. How do you know it's not some problem in the ear?
Well, yes, so we do audiometry, so we test their detection of pure tones at different frequencies and different intensities. And if it was a problem in the peripheral auditory system, then we should see that from the audiometry tests. And also, then I guess we would predict that they'd have problems with speech and other environmental noises, and they don't, generally speaking. So we're fairly sure that it's not a peripheral problem.
Thank you.
Hello. When you rated the enjoyment of music, when you asked them to rate the enjoyment of music, you found that there was some overlapping parts between the control group and the amusia group. So you tried to do different subgroups in the amusia group. Did you try to do subgroups in the amusia group for the other tests, like pitch perception or perception of whether it was going up or down? Because like maybe there are different types of amusia? Or...
I don't recall if we did, actually. But I would have thought that if their sort of appreciation could be explained by perceptual factors, then we should expect that those people who were performing most poorly on the MBEA would be those people who were enjoying music less. And the fact that we didn't see that probably persuaded us not to go further down and look at thresholds and even smaller scale aspects. Do you see what I mean?
I think so.
But you're right. I mean, I think as in any developmental disorder, I think they probably could be you could turn out to be a music for perhaps more than one underlying core reason. So some people might have perceptual difficulties, other people might have pitch span problems, etc. Yeah. So
the underlying question was, for example, I don't think you've tested the rhythm, perception of rhythm yet, but some people might be able to perceive rhythm but not pitch.
Yeah, so rhythm is interesting, and it does feature in the Montreal Battery. There's two tests involving timing. One is rhythm, one is meter. And we find the same as Isabel Peretz, which is that people who score overall in the A music range, so there's a global score that you can relate to published cutoffs, and you can say these people are A music when you look at their total score across all the subtests. But when you look at how those people do on the pitch-based subtests as opposed to the timing-based subtests, they're all very consistent in doing poorly on the pitch, the three pitch subtests, scale, contour, interval. And half of them do normally on the rhythm, and the other half do poorly. So there's real heterogeneity in terms of the timing aspect, and no one has really explained why that could be. We did run a student project where we tried to find people who scored above average on the pitch subtests but below cutoff on the timing subtests, because we wanted to isolate a kind of rhythm-specific problem. But we found such people very hard to come by. We came across about three people, and we did a few things with them, but there's a limit to what you can say when you've only got three. You know, they're probably all rather a bit different. So what I've talked about today is definitely focusing in on people who've got pitch-based problems, but no doubt there may be people who have rhythm problems in addition to the pitch problem, but I don't know about this kind of rhythm-specific problem. If anyone's watched the Motorcycle Diaries, Che Guevara's journeys through Latin America, there's a nice scene when he's staying in a convent and he's apparently so bad at music, he's at a dance, and he wants his friend to indicate when they're playing a mambo or a tango or something so that he can do the right dance to impress the ladies. But his friend got really excited, and Shay thought that he was signalling that it was a tango. So he starts doing the tango, and it's the mambo. So it was, yeah, anyway, it's quite a good clip. But apparently he did have difficulties that probably were not just to do with timing, but maybe pitch as well. Though, of course, this is anecdotal stuff that you can't say much about, but it's just an interesting clip from the film.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, I was just wondering if you've done any correlation to people with associative learning difficulties, dyslexia and things.
We screen those people out, actually. Because if people with dyslexia did poorly on our tests, we wouldn't know if it was because of the dyslexia or because of the amusia. So basically tests like... Well, a number of the tests we do involve sequencing, which people with dyslexia are typically poor at. So in order to get some sort of clear idea of what's going on in amusia, we need our deficit to be as pure as possible. That's not to say that, you know, it's not to deny perhaps the comorbidity of those disorders. It's just to say that for our purposes, we want to keep things as specific as possible to exclude interpretations based on other problems.
But does that not rather skew your sample base to... You're effectively disassociating, I'd have thought, quite a high percentage, significant percentage of people by excluding...
I don't really think it's skewing it. In any developmental disorder, there's often high comorbidity of these... these disorders, but I think including such people would actually contribute kind of noise to our data and prevent us from seeing kind of the big picture. I mean, you know, if we have the luxury of having many, many participants in the future, then we could say, well, how do people with amusia and dyslexia look? as opposed to people with just a museum. We could just do that more fine-grained analysis, but, you know, mostly people are working with sample sizes of 10, and we're quite lucky that we've got this pool that's extended to 40, although we never, you know, people, we only ever really test about 16 to 20 at a time, and we have to be careful about over-testing. But, yeah, they're just very rare. I think this lady had a question.
In your studies, have you established any ways of a relearning process for people? You know,
very interesting.
You know, like with if you're teaching, can you teach them to hear differently?
I will know the answer to that in a few months. So I have a master's student on the Music Mind and Brain course who's a professional singing teacher, and there's also a colleague of mine, Graham Welch, who's at the Institute of Education, and he's a specialist in the development of singing. And he's, when I've told him in the past that about this research, he's been very sceptical that it even that something such as a museum even exists. And he said, "Bring me these people, Lauren. I just don't believe you. I could teach any of them, you know." And I think he said that to a number of people working on a museum, but most people run a mile from him. Whereas I actually, especially when I had this student who's a professional singing teacher, I was sort of up for the challenge, really. So we asked the many of the A Musics if they wanted a course of 10 weeks of singing tuition, and five of them really jumped at the chance. So my student, Sue Anderson, is working with them, and we are doing pre- and post-testing to see if this can be rehabilitated in some way. Maybe it can, because the brain is rather plastic, so that would be extremely interesting, although it would reduce our sample for doing for future experiments on a museum, so I've got mixed feelings about that study.
Thank you. I have a quick question. Would the studies that you've performed show, and if so, have you seen any evidence of a sort of super museum where people with exceptionally high ability to detect pitch?
Actually, we've done a study. So many people who ask that question say, well, isn't it people with perfect pitch that are the opposite of these people with amusia? And you didn't say that, but I always say to them that actually people with absolute pitch are not necessarily more superior in their pitch discrimination, but they just have this qualitatively different way of perceiving pitch, which is to associate it with a label. So really the opposite of amusics might be considered people like piano tuners, because they are very sensitive to very tiny, tiny differences. But on the other hand, the way they do their tuning is to listen out for beating of frequencies. So they're using kind of temporal mechanisms. So I'm not really sure if they're the exact sort of opposite. But we're working with them because we're interested in whether there's any brain specializations that have developed as a result of a lifetime of listening for these particular modulations in amplitude. We've got a few findings from that study that should be out.
We could probably furnish you with some other people who could hear some you know some things that were very difficult for other people to hear as well from the AES. There's a whether or not there's a full basis in truth, but I think there's often a learning process about hearing
right.
You know specific problems with a machine or you know some process that probably people learn to hear in our group the specifics of those issues.
Yeah, another question. Does the ability to differentiate all these things that you've analysed so far decrease with age?
Yes, in a way. The performance on the Montreal Battery, we do see that declines a little bit, I think, after 70. But, I mean, it doesn't drop off. People don't become a music. It's just like a gradual decline. And maybe some of that's to do with memory demands. But certainly, I don't know about. We'd have to do a proper study varying age, but I think not radically.
I was just thinking of, they say that the mosquitoes in shops that pitch that they can hear it, and adults can't hear it. I was just wondering if there's any correlation there.
Who can hear things?
When children.
Oh, right, yeah.
Potential thugs or hoodies go into shops. Apparently they can hear a loud-pitched sound.
Yeah, but that's more to do with peripheral auditory system as opposed to anything central, so to do with the cochlea. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Back to the earlier discussion is what is the opposite of amusia, and you're saying how piano tuners they use the concept of beats, but any musician who's not playing essentially a percussion instrument,
yeah,
piano or organ, where they have no control of the pitch, they have to control the pitch all the time. So string players, woodwind players,
yeah,
you have to get the fingering right, but that's not enough to play in tune. So you're not thinking about semitones, you're thinking much finer than that.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, I think you're right there. Yeah, in which case they would be interesting to look at. There have been many studies of musicians versus non-musicians on various different aspects, but we would predict them to have superior thresholds, I guess. Not so much, I don't know what to predict about pitch memory, possibly superior. I mean, they would be probably better on all of these measures, really, because that's kind of
what they're using.
They've practiced it for years and years.
Yeah.
There's an interesting study by a guy called Hristo Pantev, who works at the Rotman Institute in Canada, and he did this study measuring electrophysiological responses in musicians to the tones of the particular instrument that someone was trained on. So if you're a trumpeter, he would just play you trumpet tones, and as a comparison, play you violin tones, and he was measuring a response from the... Well, I think it originated from the auditory cortex. And what he found was that there was an elevated response to the timbre of the instrument on which you were expert. So violinists listening to violin tones as opposed to trumpet tones would have an amplification of the response for violin tones and vice versa for trumpeters. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be quite specific at that stage. So, yeah, there's all sorts of interesting things to do with training, and that's kind of another strand of my research that I'm interested in.
Right, I think that's probably about all we have time for. I'm sure we could probably go on all night asking Lauren questions about this such a fascinating subject. So thanks once again,
Thank
Lauren.
You.